she'd done. I took a step toward her and she lifted her hands. Something rose to the surface of the water beside her. A sliver of pale, unmoving flesh. "Fern," I whispered. "What have you done?" Fern. Time passes. It's one of the few things in life that I can rely on. The library is my solace. Once my colleagues recover from their initial shock at my pregnancy, their questions about the paternity of my baby cease, and they are extremely supportive. Gail knits me a pair of baby booties, and Linda gifts me a bunny rug. Carmel purchases me a book of 10,001 baby names. I haven't told anyone yet that I'm not going to be the one naming the baby, or putting booties on it, or wrapping it in a bunny rug. It feels like the sort of thing that I'd be better off waiting to tell them. If I tell them at all. At home, Rose vacillates between pestering me about what I am eating, how much I am working, whether I am exercising, and pampering me. Last night, for example, I came home and found Rose on her knees setting up a foot spa for me. "To relax after being on your feet all day." Owen, Rose tells me, is finishing up his contract and will be back in time for the baby's birth. I'm looking forward to having him back, and it's clear Rose is too. She thanks me profusely and often for giving her her life back. It occurs to me that this is exactly what I wanted to do for her in the first place, give her a baby and restore her relationship with Owen. I don't understand why it doesn't feel as good as I expected. Every day, I think about Wally. I don't pause to think about him or allow myself to think about him. He's merely in the periphery of my every thought, like the smoky edges of an old photo. He's there every time I stare at someone, every time I arrive somewhere 15 minutes early, every time I put in my earplugs or put on my goggles, every time I feel a movement in my belly. He's part of everything. Every now and again, after Rose has gone to bed, I hop on the iPad and search his name. I usually only ever get hits for old articles about Shout. But one day, when I'm about 7 months along, a new article about him pops up, along with a photo. He's wearing his navy suit with the tapered pants. His hair is combed with a side part again, and his glasses are new. And he looks positively terrified. The article is announcing Follow Up, his new app, the headline declaring that he has smashed back onto the scene with an app that makes Shout look amateur. I don't read the article. I'm too taken by the photograph. I touch the screen, half expecting to feel the stubbly skin of his cheek under my hand. Then, after checking that Rose is nowhere to be seen, I lean forward and kiss the screen, right where his lips are. I survive the next couple of weeks mostly thanks to Rose, who feeds me, cares for me, even ties my shoes when I can't reach. When I become too pregnant, Rose offers to shave my legs. It is hard to describe the intimacy of this. I can't imagine having anyone in the world but Rose do this for me. Nor can I imagine the alternative, leaving them unshaven. In this way, as well as many others, my sister holds the key to my sanity, even though I never gave it to her. Owen's return is delayed and then delayed again. In the meantime, Rose and I busy ourselves with what she'd previously deemed to be Owen tasks, such as assembling the crib and the changing table and painting the nursery. I relish the opportunity to be busy, to take my mind off the baby, Billy, Mum, Wally, all of the things I've lost or am losing. In the 9th month, I'm still working at the library. With all the excitement of my impending delivery, Rose seems to have abandoned her quest for me to give up work and rest around the clock, which is great, even if I do spend more time than usual in the secret cupboard. It's tiring, the third trimester. Aside from the Braxton Hicks contractions I get periodically, my legs have become quite swollen and I get terrible pelvis pain if I'm on my feet for more than an hour or two. Carmel doesn't seem to mind it when I disappear. She doesn't even ask where I am anymore. It's funny how at first I'd thought Carmel was so different from Janet, but now, as it turns out, I think they would have liked each other quite a lot. One morning at the library, I find myself making small talk with Gail. It starts out normal, with her asking me how I've been, a question that I've always found difficult to answer. Usually I ignore this kind of question, pretend I didn't hear, but today, on a whim, I decide to indulge her. "Are you inquiring after my physical health, Gail?" She appears to think about this as if she herself isn't entirely sure. After contemplating for a few moments, she says, "I suppose I'm asking if anything of interest has happened to you lately." "But how am I supposed to know what is of interest to you?" Gail thinks again. "You know, that's a good question. Perhaps you can tell me if anything of interest to you has happened lately." I think about this. "Well, let's see. I read Kelly Rimmer's new novel, The Things We Cannot Say, over the weekend. I thoroughly enjoyed it." Gail beams. "I read her last one and loved it. It must have been out last summer because I remember sitting outside on my garden swing with a gin and tonic while I read it." Before I know it, Gail and I have discussed gin, garden swings, and her new herb garden, as well as Kelly Rimmer's other books, and none of it has felt like a chore in the least. The fact that we are focused on our work as we talk assists with this, I believe. We are still chatting comfortably when the automatic doors slide open. "Isn't that your sister, Fern?" I glance up, instantly annoyed. Rose hasn't been back since the last time I told her it wasn't convenient, and I'd thought she'd got the message. "Rose," I say before she can speak, "I'm sorry, but I'm working." Rose shoots a look at Gail. "I know, but this is important. Is there somewhere we can speak in private?" "At home," I suggest. "Tonight?" She shakes her head. "Now, Fern." Rose and I appear to have come to something of a stalemate. I let out a long sigh. "Go into the courtyard," Gail whispers. "I'll cover for you." Carmel has been so lenient with me lately that I'm not sure I would need anyone to cover for me, but I appreciate the sentiment, so I don't point this out. Instead, I thank Gail and head outside to the courtyard with Rose. As we walk, Rose peppers me with inane questions about my day, the weather, if Gail has recently changed her hair, and by the time we reach the courtyard, I'm feeling a little uneasy. Rose doesn't typically make small talk with me. She knows I dislike chatter for chatter's sake, and the rapid fire of today makes me wonder if something is wrong. "What is it, Rose?" I say. Thankfully, Rose doesn't draw it out. "It's Mum." It is perhaps the very last thing I expect her to say. Rose doesn't impart information about Mum to me, it's the other way around. Rose hasn't seen Mum in years. "What about Mum?" I ask. I notice Rose's face is unusually somber. "I just had a call from Sun Meadows." This is odd. Why would Sun Meadows call Rose? "Why would they call you?" Rose looks a little sheepish. "I'm Mum's emergency contact." I stare at her. I have been visiting Mum every week for 16 years and Rose is Mum's emergency contact? She takes a long, deep breath. "It's not good news, Fern. Mum, she died." I hear the words. I understand them. And yet I feel nothing. I become oddly aware of all the sounds around me. The birds in the nearby tree. My breath whooshing past my ears. My heart beating. "There aren't many details yet," Rose says. "They will probably have to do an autopsy. They think it must have been a stroke." "But she couldn't have had a stroke. She was in good health. Better than ever." Rose shrugs. "Unfortunately, even healthy people have strokes sometimes." A tear slips from my eye, and I wipe it away quickly with my shirt sleeve. Another immediately takes its place. "I know this is hard for you, Fern. I know you loved her." "Can I see her?" I ask. Rose shakes her head. "They've already taken her for the autopsy." I stare at her. Already? Yes. But when did she die? The hospital called me yesterday. Apparently, she didn't wake up in the morning.
Yesterday? Mum's been dead for a whole day and you didn't tell me?
Rose looks surprised.
Please don't get upset, Fern.
I try to fathom how I could not be upset. It is, after all, exquisitely upsetting.
I'll take you home,
Rose says, placing a hand on my arm.
Why don't you wait here a minute and I'll explain what has...
No, I say, pulling my arm free and wrapping it around myself. I'm staying here. But Rose is already walking back toward the door to the library.
I'm sure they'll understand, Fern.
No! It comes out louder than I intend, but at least Rose stops walking. I don't want to go home. I have work to do. Rose stares at me.
Really? You want to stay here?
Yes.
You're sure?
I am. Rose looks confused. I'm not sure why. The library has been my home for as long as I can remember. After a lifetime together, you'd think she would have known that. But more and more lately, I get the feeling that Rose doesn't know me at all. I feel agitated as I walk back into the library. I don't pause as I pass Gail and Carmel, I just continue straight into the secret cupboard. Inside, I pull my phone from my pocket and dial Sun Meadows. A receptionist named Jessica answers the phone.
Good morning, Sun Meadows. How may I assist you?
My name is Fern Castle. My mother, Nina Castle, was a patient there, and I have just been informed that she has passed away. Can I speak to someone about this, please? The receptionist tells me she's sorry for my loss and then asks if I can hold the line. I've always thought that was a stupid saying. After all, what line do they want me to hold? But today I am too upset to worry about it. After a minute, she patches me through.
Hello? Says the voice.
Hello, I say. My mother Nina was a patient and...
Fern? She says. It's Onab. I was one of your mother's nurses. I'm so sorry for your loss.
Oh, I say, realizing that until that very moment I'd been holding on to hope that it had been some kind of terrible mistake. Thank you, Onab.
Your mother was a very nice lady, she says. I always enjoyed looking after her.
I inhale a wobbly breath. Thank you, Onab. I wanted to check if you knew anything about the cause of Mum's death yet.
I'm sorry, she says. It will be at least a few days before we get the results of the autopsy.
I sink into the armchair.
It may be of some comfort that I saw your mother the evening before she died. She seemed happy. To see your sister at last, I think, really lifted her spirits.
I repeat the sentence in my head, making sure I had interpreted correctly. But I couldn't have. Mum saw Rose?
Yes. At least I think it was her. Small girl, brunette.
I can't believe it. Rose visited Mum. She visited her. I let my head fall back against the armchair. Any anger I'd felt toward Rose dissipates. What that must have meant to Mum.
Is there anything else I can help you with, Fern? Onab asks after a brief silence.
No, I say, wiping a tear away. You've already helped enough. I don't know how long I sit in the secret cupboard. It might be 10 minutes. It might be an hour. No one bothers me. Every time I think it's time to leave, I don't even get to a standing position before I change my mind and decide to stay where I am. I am starting to suspect that I might spend the night in this cupboard when I hear a gentle knock at the door.
Fern, there's a gentleman here who would like to talk to you.
It's Carmel talking. I think about staying silent, pretending I'm not here. I can't face anyone.
I told him I wasn't sure if you were here or not. It's Wally? I can send him away if you don't want to...
No! I say, too quickly and too loudly. I'll talk to him. I'm not thinking clearly, obviously.
I have no explanation for the fact that I'm visibly pregnant. At the same time, I simply can't be this near and not go to him. It is a physical impossibility. For now, I put Mum's death away in the back of my mind to think about later. Wally and Mum all together is simply too much for me. I practically run to the reception area. Carmel is at my heels. As Wally comes into view, wearing his suit again, I am so overcome that I can't even manage a smile. Neither can he. His eyes are fixed on my belly. "So it's true," he says. "You're pregnant." "How did you know?" "Rose told me."
"What?"
I decide I must have misheard.
"Rose told you I was pregnant?"
He nods.
"But when did you see Rose?"
Wally's face gets a funny look to it then, like he is sucking the inside of his cheeks. I'm not sure if he's confused or upset, or even angry.
"Rose has visited me quite a few times over these past few months, Fern."
Now I'm certain I've misheard.
"She phoned me several months ago. She wanted to see me to talk about you," she said. "She came to my office."
It doesn't make sense. Rose has spent these past few months telling me not to contact Wally. She couldn't have contacted Wally herself.
"She's been back several times since," he says.
"To talk about me? Why?"
"Good question, since she's barely mentioned you, not that first day or any other time."
I struggle to take it in.
"Well, what did she want then?"
He shrugs.
"First, she wanted to have coffee. Then she suggested lunch. Each time I agreed because I wanted to know how you were doing. But she never told me much about you, other than that you were happy with your new boyfriend. Then, yesterday, she told me you were pregnant."
I don't understand. Why would Rose say that after making me promise I wouldn't tell him?
"She said she's been on the fence about whether to say anything because you'd made her swear to keep it a secret. But now that you're in financial trouble, she said she had to reach out."
I open my eyes.
Financial trouble? My head is spinning.
Wally watches me closely, his eyes on my face, as if he'd expected my surprise. But I still don't understand. It feels like everyone is in on a secret except me.
"Wally, I'm not in financial trouble."
"Rose said you'd say that. She said you're too proud to admit it."
"Well, I'm not."
He takes a few deep breaths.
"How far along are you?"
"Nearly 8 months."
It's a miracle that I'm able to fudge the date given the amount of noise in my head. Wally is here, standing right in front of me. It feels like a dream.
He sneaks a look at me. "And you and the new guy are okay?"
I almost say, "What new guy?" Then I remember. He's talking about the father, the fictional father of my baby.
I manage a nod,
but I'm thinking of that phone conversation Rose and I had after she found out Wally had founded Shout. I remember the excitement in her voice. $100 million, she'd said.
"I'm sorry."
Wally reaches out and touches my shoulder.
"I've upset you."
"I'm just confused. I don't know why Rose came to you."
"She came to me," he says, "because she knows I care about you. She knows that I'd give you the money in a heartbeat if you needed it."
Wally clears his throat.
"And she used that information to try to get money for herself, Fern, not for you."
I shake my head.
"No, that can't be right."
"Look, Fern, I know you've met someone else. But Rose is right, I do still care about you. And as someone who cares about you, I feel a responsibility to tell you that I think something is very wrong with your sister. Very, very wrong."
I shake my head. I don't want to believe it, but deep down I have a horrible feeling that he is right.
"I think something is very wrong with your sister."
An hour after Wally leaves the library, I'm still ruminating on that. Is he right? And if he is, why am I the last to know about it? Is it one of those things I don't notice,
Like people communicating with their facial expressions? Is it possible that because of the way I see things, I've been missing an entire side of Rose? I think suddenly of Mum. She'd always worried so much about Rose. Was that because something was wrong with her? I slide my phone out of my pocket and stare at it a moment, thinking. After hearing about Rose contacting Wally, asking him for money, I'm questioning everything. Finally, I redial the number for Sun Meadows. The same receptionist answers and I ask to speak to Onab.
"Hello again, Fern," Onab says. "Is there something else I can help you with?"
"Yes. I'd like to know who the last person was to see Mum alive." A pause.
"Well, let's see. It would have been whichever nurse was on night duty. I can check the schedule. She would have checked on everyone during night rounds."
"Would that have been before or after Rose visited Mum?"
"Hmm," she says. "Actually, I'm not sure."
"Rose hadn't seen Mum for a long time. It was her first visit in 10 years, I say suddenly. I'm not sure why. Perhaps I want assurance that this, combined with Mum's unexpected death, doesn't mean anything. Onab is quiet for a long time, but I can hear her breathing, so I know she's still there.
"Fern, as far as I know, the death isn't being treated as suspicious. Is there any reason you think it should be?"
I repeat the question in my head.
"Fern?"
she says again. I want to respond, as she has asked a question. It's just that I don't know the answer. The afternoon passes in a blur. I serve people, restack books, do all the things I'm supposed to do. But my mind is anywhere but the library. The Braxton Hicks kick in around 2 o'clock p.m. I time them on a notepad as I go about my business at the library. Some people get all panicky about Braxton Hicks, but I've read the books. I know they are only real when contractions are increasing in frequency and intensity. I get some relief from my thoughts and my pains by getting lost in my work, helping an elderly man find a selection of reading material about the Titanic to prepare for a talk he is giving at his Rotary Club.
"No romances," he'd said, pointing a finger at me accusingly. "Nothing with Leo DiCaprio or people getting steamy as the ship begins to sink."
I provide toiletries to a young homeless woman, and even give her my own sandwich for lunch, as after my interaction with Wally I'm not feeling especially hungry. Then I go to tidy the children's section, which is looking a bit worse for wear after the toddler drawing class that morning. By 3:30 p.m., my Braxton Hicks are getting more consistent in timing, around 10 minutes apart for almost an hour. And while the pain is not debilitating, I'm starting to find it difficult to concentrate on my work.
"Are you all right, Fern?"
Carmel says when she finds me in the archive area breathing quietly through a cramp.
"Fine," I say. "I'm fine."
She watches me closely.
"Why don't you go home early today? You look a little tired."
I am taken aback at the suggestion. I've only taken 2 sick days in my entire working career and have only left early once for an emergency dental appointment. But with Carmel offering, and after the day I've had, I find myself nodding. "All right," I say. "Thanks, Carmel."
"Would you like me to order a taxi to take you home?" Carmel says.
"A taxi would be great," I tell Carmel. I don't tell her that I'm not going home. By the time I arrive at the hospital, my contractions are 4 minutes apart. Inside, everything is orderly and signposted, and I find the maternity ward promptly and report my arrival at the desk. The nurses are impressed with the documentation I provide, detailing the steady increase in the frequency of my contractions over the past few hours. Upon seeing me double over to breathe through a contraction, they unanimously agree that I should be taken straight through to the delivery room. A nurse with grey hair and a navy blue cardigan is the one to take me through. I follow her into a bustling hive of activity, people in scrubs and masks requesting assistance or giving it, the phone ringing, people chatting. From an adjacent room, I hear a low moan reminiscent of a cow's. At the same time, a nurse walks by carrying an icy pole that smells like grapes and bubblegum. I pause as a particularly strong contraction takes hold. My nurse pauses with me, administers a firm rub to my lower back, and tells me, "You're doing great, love." When it has passed, I follow her into a bright room, delivery room 4. A gown lies on the vinyl bed. In one corner, a tray of instruments sits beside a medical-looking crib, complete with overhead warmer. "Your baby will be in there soon," the nurse says, flicking a switch. The crib lights up, emitting a low hum that travels through me like a mild electrical current. From somewhere outside the room, I hear someone whimper. It makes me jump. "Pop that on, love," the nurse says, gesturing to the gown. "Everything off underneath, including bra and undies. Then take a seat on the bed and the doctor will soon be in to examine you. Is someone on their way to be with you?" "What? No. The nurse is headed for the door to give me some privacy, but then she pauses. "Oh, is there someone I can call for you?" I shake my head, but suddenly I'm not so sure. The lights, the sounds, the strange people. "Oh, love," she says kindly, "labor can be hard work. You'll want someone here to support you. A friendly face, someone you trust." Someone I trust. How complicated that statement has become. What if the person I trust most in the world is entirely untrustworthy, I want to ask. And then another thought occurs to me. And what if she is the one person I can't get through this thing without? "Fine," I say finally. "There is someone." Rose arrives at the hospital 15 minutes after the nurse, Beverly, calls. In that short time, my pain level has gone from manageable to torturous. "Why didn't you call me earlier?" Rose snaps as she bustles in. "We had a plan, remember?" "Enough of that," Beverly says firmly, glancing up from her notes. "I don't want anyone upsetting our mother-to-be." I glance at Rose. Rose has never taken well to people ticking her off. So I'm surprised when she gives Beverly a tight smile, removes her handbag, and places it on the window ledge. "You're right," she says. "I'm sorry. Are you all right?" This is one for the books. I can't remember Rose ever saying sorry to me. Ever. "I'm fine," I say, before realizing this is far from the truth. My body is tensed up, my arms are wrapped around myself, and I'm rocking gently. Rose looks at me knowingly. "Busy in here, right?" she says softly. "It's all right, I'll take care of everything." To her credit, take care of things she does. In a matter of minutes, Rose has dimmed the lights, closed the door, opened the window, and explained to every nurse that I don't like people crowding me. Then she helps me down off the bed, explaining that I need to move around. Within a few minutes, I can breathe again. That's the funny thing. Whatever else Rose has done, I realize, she is the only person on earth who can do this for me. Rose is outside talking to the doctor when Beverly comes back to check my progress. I am sitting on the chair, the only place I feel comfortable. I tell Beverly I don't want to get on the bed, and she replies, "Of course, love. I can check you right where you are." I am starting to warm to Beverly. I'm even becoming fond of her saying love. While she's checking me, she says casually, "Your sister tells me you are being a surrogate for her? What an amazing gift." I manage a nod. "I would have loved to have a child. They didn't use surrogates in my day, though. Even if they did, I only had a brother. I had friends, but it really seems like a sister thing, being a surrogate. I imagine being twins, the bond is even more unique. If you get along, that is." She laughs. Beverly doesn't seem to be expecting an answer, and I am glad. If she had, I might have told her the truth. That people without sisters think it's all sunshine and lollipops or all blood and guts. But actually, it's always both. Sunshine and guts, lollipops and blood, good and bad. The bad is as essential to the relationship as the good. Maybe the bad is even more important, because that's what ties you together. The pain of labor is blinding. At first there is a rhythm to it, but after a while it's just pain. Breathtaking, magnificent pain. People I don't know are constantly touching me, assessing me, talking about me. When they talk to me, Rose answers on my behalf. I am grateful. It allows me to close my eyes and retreat into myself, remaining silent apart from the low animalistic grunts that emanate from me every minute or so as I struggle through a contraction. It makes sense to me, this noise, because in a way, I have become nothing more than an animal. At some point, I am offered pain relief, which I decline. For this, I am lauded by Rose and the nurses and told I am strong, when in fact I have refused it simply because I cannot bear the idea of anyone else touching me, even to administer pain relief. For now, I'll take the physical pain over the mental. But I am not strong. I think I might die. If not from the pain, then from the sensory overload. It comes at me from every angle. I am certain I would die if not for Rose. She anticipates my needs. A cold drink, ice chips, space, and takes care of them quietly and without fuss. She never touches me without asking, and questions those who insist on touching me, confirming that it is absolutely necessary. She talks to the nurses, and then reports back to me periodically. It won't be long, things are going well. And finally, the baby will be born within the hour. 20 minutes later, when my water breaks, the room fills with people and the lights are turned up. It's too loud. Too bright. I can't breathe. You're 10 centimeters, Beverly says. It's time to push. I shake my head. I can't. I need to get out of here. I try to stand, but faces and hands rush in trying to stop me. It makes it worse. Then I hear Rose. Just give us some space. They step back slightly, but it's not enough. I'm too hot. It's too much. Fern, you can do this, Rose says. You have to do this, for the baby. I shake my head again. Rose looks around at the people crowding around me. I see the powerlessness on her face. She can't make these people go away. They are here to deliver the baby. They won't go anywhere. She looks back at me. Her eyes are filled with tears. Close your eyes. Imagine you are somewhere safe. The library. You have all the space you need. And you are with someone that you trust. I do as she says. And it's Wally's face that I picture as I give birth to our daughter. Journal of Rose Ingrid Castle. I tried to save Billy. I ran into the water, hooked my arms around his shoulders, and tried to lift him out of the water. But he was heavier than I expected. A dead weight. Billy? I gently slapped his face. Come on, Billy. Billy didn't come on. He didn't turn his head to suck in a breath, or cough and splutter, or gasp for air. He didn't do anything. I dragged him to the shore and started trying to administer CPR. I had no idea what I was doing, but I'd seen it on television. As I tried to breathe life back into Billy, Fern stood beside me silently. When it was clear Billy wasn't coming back, I fell onto the shore beside him and dropped my head into my hands. All I could think was, Fern couldn't go to jail. She couldn't. It was misguided, the wrong thing to do, but she'd clearly done it to protect me. She didn't understand the consequences, not really. I needed to protect her. Billy was desperate to stay underwater longer than you, right? I said after several silent seconds. To beat your time? Fern blinked in confusion. He dived into the water, Fern. He got tangled in the reeds. We thought he was holding his breath. By the time we realized he was in trouble, it was too late. That's what you need to say when anyone asks you questions about this. Billy got tangled in the reeds, and he drowned, okay? Fern listened intently and agreed.
Luckily, this time she followed instructions to the letter. Fern. When I rouse from sleep, I keep my eyes closed for a few seconds, steeling myself for an onslaught to the senses. It's been an arduous 24 hours. Every time I open my eyes, there's someone different in my room, checking on the baby or me, or bringing me food or medicine. The last time I awoke from a nap, for example, it was to quite the kerfuffle. Rose was here. She was over by the baby's crib, speaking to one of the nurses. "Has she been breastfed?" Rose had said. The kind, soothing voice Rose had used during my labor had gone. She sounded angry. "Yes, last night and early this morning. What is the..." "The problem is I am the baby's mother and I did not want the surrogate breastfeeding." "I do apologize," the nurse, not Beverly, had said. "It wasn't written in the notes. Let me look into this for you." Rose and I had discussed breastfeeding on occasion during the pregnancy, of course. Each time Rose said how awful it was, the pressure that breastfeeding Nazis put on new mothers, and assured me that formula was perfectly adequate in this day and age. But she'd never explicitly said she didn't want me to breastfeed. And so, during the night, when Rose had gone home and the nurse put the baby to my breast, I hadn't seen any reason not to give it a go. The breastfeeding had brought on some afterbirth pains, and the nurse had been kind enough to administer some medication, which was fantastically effective. Possibly too effective, bringing on a temporary euphoria and then putting me to sleep within minutes of taking it. I've never been a big taker of painkillers, but after a few of these pills, I have to admit I'm wondering why. Now, when I open my eyes, Rose is at my bedside again, this time reading a John Grisham novel. I don't know how long I stare at her before she turns to look at me and frowns. She looks like she's going to speak, but she is interrupted by a young blonde nurse with a high ponytail who appears in the doorway. "Time for a feed," the nurse says brightly, and Rose immediately puts down her book and starts rummaging in her tote. "Come on in," she says to the nurse. "Ah, here they are. I brought these bottles from home. We're going to be formula feeding." Something about the way Rose says it sounds funny. Formula feeding. I laugh out loud. It is, perhaps, the medication. Rose and the nurse both frown at me for a moment before turning their attention to the baby.
"How is the little one doing?" the nurse asks. "Does she have a name yet?"
"Not yet," I call. But they ignore me.
"I was thinking about Alice," Rose says. "Very pretty," the nurse says. "And how's Mum doing?"
"Fine," Rose says. "She's good." Neither of them even look at me. It's as if, having now birthed the baby, I've been absorbed into the environment, disappeared. The idea makes me laugh again. This time they look at each other, but not at me.
"I'll go make up the formula, shall I?"
the nurse says, and Rose nods. When the nurse has left, Rose comes to my side. "Did you ask Wally for money?" She blinks.
"How do you know about that?"
I laugh.
"Wally told me." "You've seen Wally?"
"Yes, yesterday afternoon, at the library." In her crib, the baby begins to fuss. The sound of it causes my breasts to leak through my nightie. But I've barely had a chance to look at her before Rose picks her up and puts her to her shoulder.
"I'm sorry I didn't tell you," she says carefully. "But it makes sense, doesn't it? He is the baby's father, and he has plenty of money. Why shouldn't he support her?"
"Why would he?" I ask. "He doesn't know she is his daughter. Besides, do you really need the money? Surely Owen makes enough money to support her." The baby's fuss becomes a cry. I want to take her from Rose, but she walks away from me to the window. "What is it?" I ask when she remains silent. "Rose?"
"I wasn't going to tell you until after I took Alice home."
Rose's back is still to me as she looks out the window.
"But, as it turns out, Owen wasn't coping so well with the idea of raising another man's child. After giving it a lot of thought, he's decided he can't do it. He's staying in London indefinitely.
I stare at her back. Rose turns around.
I know how important it is to you that this baby is raised in a two-parent family. But it wasn't meant to be.
She comes to the side of my bed and puts a hand over mine.
Look, you've had a big 24 hours. What you need right now is sleep. I'll get the nurse to get you some more painkillers. Everything will make sense later.
I have my doubts about that. My baby might be raised by a sister I'm not sure I trust, with no husband and no money. At the same time, I can't bear to think about any of this anymore. So when the nurse returns a few minutes later with the formula and some more medication for me, I swallow it down and go back to sleep. I sleep. Late afternoon, Rose heads home for a shower and to change her clothes, and I am left alone with the baby, who is tucked up close next to my bed, wrapped snugly in her pink blanket. It's astonishing how easy it is to while away the time just staring at her, marveling at her tiny eyelashes and squashed-up chin and wisps of black hair falling out the sides of her knitted hat. I must do it for hours before my eye is drawn to a woman standing just outside my door talking to one of my nurses. Her sister has advised that now would be a good time, the woman is saying. She appears to be in her late 30s or early 40s, and she smiles when she catches my eye. Ah, Fern, she says, taking a few steps into my room. You're awake. Who are you?
My name is Naomi Davison. I'm an adoption counsellor. I've been speaking with your sister Rose, and I wondered if now would be an okay time to have a chat with you. I promise I won't take long.
The nurse remains beside the woman. I get the feeling that if I give some indication that I'm not interested, she will be whisked away. But I am curious. All right. She drags a chair up to the bed and glances briefly into the baby's crib before sitting and pulling some paperwork out of a leather satchel.
As I said, I'm an adoption counsellor. As you may or may not know, it's mandatory in Victoria for birth mothers considering adoption to have counselling prior to relinquishing their parental rights.
Naomi places a stack of documents and pamphlets on the tray table in front of me.
My services are free of charge to both yourself and the intended adoptive parents. My role today is to ensure that you understand all your options, not just adoption, okay?
Okay. I mimic her tone.
I understand that you have been considering intrafamily adoption, she says.
My blank face must convey confusion because she goes on. Intrafamily adoption is the adoption of a child by a step-parent or relative. She looks up. I hesitate, then at a loss, nod.
Okay, well, we can talk about that in a moment, but first I want to talk to you about your other options.
It's the first I have heard about other options. But Naomi informs me I have several. Placing the baby in temporary foster care, shared care, open adoption, where the child is aware of their adoption and knows who his or her birth parents are. This has been found to be the most beneficial to the child. And closed adoption, where the child doesn't know his or her true parentage. She talks about the permanence of adoption, how once a child has been adopted, the adoptive parent will continue to be the child's legal guardian even in the event of a marriage breakdown or divorce. There is also the option of raising the baby myself. It's a lot of information, a lot of options I didn't know I had.
If you decide to proceed with intrafamily adoption, you will be required to sign papers relinquishing your parental rights. After signing these papers, you will have 30 days to submit a signed revocation should you change your mind. After this time, you will be unable to change your mind. In order to make the adoption official, we require the signature of both biological parents, except in such circumstance where the father isn't known, which I understand is the case here.
This time she doesn't wait for a nod, and I'm glad.
As a registered adoption counsellor, I can witness you signing consent documents. Your sister has already signed this one. If you feel ready, you can sign it today. If not, you can take as long as you need and then give me a call and I will come back.
I look at the document with Rose's signature at the bottom and my mind swims. The problem, I realise, is that there are two Rosies. The Rose I rely on and the other Rose, the Rose who hated Mum. The Rose who goes behind my back to speak to Wally. The Rose who would possibly betray me to get the baby she wants so badly. I don't know which Rose I'm getting. I don't know which Rose my baby would get. If it's all right with you, I say, I'd like you to come back.
Journal of Rose Ingrid Castle. Everyone accepted that Billy had accidentally drowned, even Daniel. The river was full of reeds, and he had been trying to beat Fern's time for the whole week. The coroner recorded a verdict of death by misadventure, which meant our plan worked. Fern got away with murder. But lately, I'm wondering if I did the wrong thing, covering for her. Maybe by not allowing her to face the consequences of her actions, I've created a monster. There's no doubt that Fern can be dangerous when she's angry. And now that there is a baby involved, I'm terrified that she will pay the price for my mistake.
Fern. When my 3 hourly medications are due, the nurse makes her rounds and I opt to take the full dose. Oblivion is preferable to all the thoughts swirling in my mind. Owen is not going to raise the baby with Rose. Rose wants Wally to give her money. Wally thinks there is something wrong with Rose. Mum is dead, and Rose was the last person to see her. It's too much for my brain to handle. I can see, all at once, the appeal of drugs. Understand the calling of an addict. By the time Rose returns to the hospital, I am nearly asleep. I keep my eyes closed, but I feel her in the room. I'm not sure if her presence is a comfort or a threat. I am still musing on this when I hear a distinct American accent coming from just outside my doorway. I'm here to see Fern. My eyes spring open. I'd have thought I was having some sort of drug-induced fantasy if it weren't for the speed at which Rose jumps out of her chair and runs to the door.
I wish you'd called ahead, Rocco, Rose says.
She walks into the hallway, pulling the door to my room nearly all the way closed behind her.
Unfortunately, it's not a good time.
I try to sit up, but I feel dizzy and have to lie back down.
I don't need you to tell me when an appropriate time to visit Fern is, Wally says.
His voice lacks its usual warmth. In fact, he sounds downright angry.
Actually, you do, because she's asleep.
Fine, I'll wait.
There's a short pause.
Look, I'm glad you're here. Why don't you and I go somewhere and we can...
I'm not going anywhere with you.
There's a short silence and then Rose closes the door fully. When she speaks again, I have to strain to hear.
We need to talk, Rocco.
Fine. Let's talk about how Fern says she doesn't need any money.
Of course she won't tell you that. She's ashamed. She's ashamed that she can't even raise her own baby.
What do you mean?
She's adopting the baby out to me. I'm going to raise it.
What?
I hear the wheels of a cart on the linoleum floors and then Rose says,
no thanks,
and the sound recedes.
Why is Fern giving her baby to you? That's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard.
Is it?
I can hear a thread of strain in Rose's voice.
Come on. We both know Fern isn't capable of looking after a child.
Of course she is. I think Fern would make a terrific mother.
More silence. I feel the painkillers swirl in my bloodstream, which, while not unpleasant, is quite distracting.
There are things you don't know, Rocco.
Rose sighs.
Fern's dangerous.
Wally scoffs.
If you're talking about what happened by the river when you were 12, Fern told me about that.
There is a long silence. When Rose finally speaks, she sounds uncertain.
Fern told you?
Yes.
She told you she drowned a boy in the river?
Yes, but I don't believe it.
It is hard to believe, Rose agrees. But it's true. I was there. I am the only person on earth who knows the truth about what happened.
But that isn't true. There was someone else at the river that night. Someone other than her, me, and Billy. The night before he died, Billy and I had wandered down to the river together to skim stones. We were breaking the rules. We weren't supposed to do that. Mum and Daniel told us we weren't allowed to leave the camp at night. But when Billy asked, I threw caution to the wind. There was something about Billy that made me want to do things like that. Something about his company that made him difficult to resist. He took me by surprise when he kissed me. One minute we were skimming stones, and the next our teeth were knocking together. He said, "Ow," and I laughed. Then he kissed me again. It was better that time. Still strange, but better. We were on our third kiss when Rose stepped out of the bushes, startling us both.
"Fern?"
she'd said. She'd been so quiet after that. It was almost as though she was annoyed with me. Her strange mood permeated the camp the next day. That was what happened when Rose got into one of her moods. You could feel it in your bones. By evening, Mum and Daniel were so fed up they sent us down to the river.
"Go swim," Mum said to Rose. "Shake it off."
I think Mum wanted to help, but I hated it when Mum told Rose to shake it off. It only ever made her madder. Billy and I followed Rose down to the river at a distance, but once she was there, she just stood on the bank sulking. After a few minutes, Billy strode past her and into the water. He didn't know how Rose could get when she was in one of these moods. I wanted one last swim with Billy, but I felt like I shouldn't, so I stood off to the side watching them. Billy had spent that whole week trying to hold his breath underwater longer than me, and this was his last chance, he said. But it was clear he was never going to do it. It was funny. I could have watched him try all night. After an hour or so, Rose called me over to her. I was taken aback. She'd been giving me the silent treatment all day. Usually she kept it up for 2 or 3 days before she broke it.
"Help him," she whispered.
"Help him what?"
"Help him beat your time."
I'll admit I wasn't too keen on the idea.
"Go on," Rose urged. "He'll never do it otherwise, and boys love to win."
Rose was so animated. She looked practically happy. There was something appealing about a happy Rose, especially when she'd been in such a bad mood. Letting Billy win would be a small price to pay, I supposed. So I agreed. The next time Billy broke through the surface of the water, I told him my tricks. "Breathe slowly and calmly for at least 2 minutes, then exhale everything in your lungs and take the deepest breath you possibly can. Then, once you're underwater, relax and let your thoughts drift away." Billy listened carefully before attempting it, and he did quite well for a first-timer. He was still no match for me, though. And when oxygen bubbled to the surface, I felt pleased. Until Rose said,
"Help him."
I frowned.
"What do you mean?" "Help him win."
"You mean..." She nodded. We stared at each other. I was sure I'd misunderstood.
"But it's the only way he'll beat you. Hold him down."
And so, I did. I put a hand on his back and another on the back of his head. "Only 40 seconds, I said to Rose. "Check your watch." Rose did. Billy started to struggle, but in karate I'd learned to grip well. I'd spent months developing forearm and finger strength, so he had no chance of getting free. But he was twisting and kicking. I felt very uncertain. "How long has it been?"
"Nearly there."
Rose was looking at her watch. "Now?" I said. Rose shook her head. It didn't take long before he stopped twisting. Rose kept time on her watch. I felt reassured by that. Rose wouldn't let me do anything bad to Billy. And yet it felt like an eternity before she gave the nod to release him. As soon as he rose to the surface of the water, I knew something was very wrong. I hooked my arms around his shoulders and lifted his head out of the water. "Billy?" I gently slapped his face. "Come on, Billy, wake up." But Billy didn't wake up. He didn't turn his head to suck in a breath, or cough and splutter, or gasp for air. I dragged him from the water. He was heavy, but I got him to the shore and rolled him onto his side. When he still didn't breathe, I tried to administer CPR. I'd read a book about how to do it, and we'd practiced it at school on plastic mannequins, but it was harder on an actual person. Rose just stood there, in shock. I breathed into Billy again and again. After several minutes with no response, I sat back on my heels and looked at him. He was the most unnatural color, a slippery, whitish blue. His eyes were open, but lifeless. That's when we heard Mum. "Girls?" She was looking around for us, and spotting us on the shore, she appeared relieved. Then she looked past us to where Billy lay. For a moment, she remained completely still. Then she ran. It was a sight to behold. Mum never ran anywhere.
"Billy!"
she cried, dropping to her knees beside him. She fumbled at his neck, presumably trying to feel for a pulse.
"Billy, come on, Billy. What happened?"
Rose and I remained silent as Mum herself tried to breathe life into Billy. She continued for what felt like hours, only pausing to swear under her breath and once to lift her head and say what sounded like a quick prayer, which was odd as I'd never seen Mum pray before. When she finally spun around, her face was streaked with tears and dirt.
"What happened? Someone tell me."
I was trying to help him stay underwater longer than me," I stammered. "I must have held him for too long."
"You held him under?"
Mum stared at me.
"Why would you do that, Fern?"
I glanced at Rose. Mum followed my gaze. Something funny happened to her eyes.
"Did Rose tell you to?"
Somehow, I understood the danger of answering that question. And so I didn't.
"Oh, of course it's my fault," Rose said. "Nothing could be the fault of your precious Fern."
Mum stood up and grabbed Rose so tightly that her feet lifted off the ground.
"Billy is dead, Rose. Do you understand that?"
"Yes," Rose said evenly. "I understand."
"And now you've implicated your sister."
"You've always hated me,"
Rose shouted, crying now.
"You've only ever loved Fern. Everyone loves Fern."
Mum let go of Rose and lifted a hand to Rose's face before hesitating and dropping it down.
"I don't hate you, Rose, but it does feel like you've spent your life trying to make me prove I love you. And now a boy is dead."
Mum looked down at Billy's lifeless body, then up again, meeting Rose's gaze.
"If you want to prove that you love me," Rose said, "then this is your chance."
Mid-afternoon, Rose goes to Target to get the baby some smaller clothes. The moment she is gone, I move quickly. The hospital is quiet, apart from a few mewling newborn cries. I struggle into my rainbow dress, one of many souvenirs of the bizarre brand of love Rose has for me, and I lift the baby out of her crib. She is warm and feather light. I hook my bag over my shoulder and cradle her against my chest. It's lovely how she seems to fit into the space perfectly, like she was made for this space. Perhaps she was. It's funny, she doesn't look like an Alice to me, I realize. More like a Daisy or Lily or Poppy. Or Willow? There's something about the strength of it that I like. Yes, Willow. That's her name. It is so easy to get out of the hospital that I don't feel like I am breaking out at all. I skulk past reception and out into the street, covering Willow's face with the blanket as we walk past the smokers. There is a taxi idling there, having just let an elderly man and woman out, which is perfect. I may not be the best mother for my baby, but I am becoming more and more certain with each passing moment that Rose isn't either. I feed Willow in the taxi, and she falls into an open-mouthed sleep. I have nothing other than my handbag. No nappies, no clothes. At least I have milk, and judging by how sore my breasts are, more milk is coming in. All in all, it could be worse. When we pull up, I half expect Rose to be standing there, her faux concern pasted onto her face, ready to launch into a speech about how this kind of behavior is exactly why I can't be a mother to this baby. Maybe she's right. Still, I'm delighted to find that she isn't here. For once, it seems, I'm one step ahead of Rose. I ask the driver to let us out at the back of the library. My plan is ill thought out at best. I'm not even sure it is a plan. All I know is that I have to call Wally. I have to tell him he is the father of my baby. Even if he is upset with me for not telling him, he will surely help me figure out the right thing to do. I know now that the right thing is not to leave my baby in Rose's care. I let myself into the library through the back door. It's quiet inside, so I manage to make my way down the muted, carpeted hallway without being noticed. Through the opaque glass window, I can see people moving about in the staff room, and I hear Trevor's high-pitched, irritating laugh. I can't chance going across the library to the secret cupboard, so instead go through the vestibule and into the bathrooms. Inside, I enter a stall and sit on the closed toilet, resting Willow on my knees while I retrieve my phone. I have 15% battery left, which is astonishing to see. Normally, I don't let it get below 90%, but I didn't have my phone charger at the hospital. Still, 15% is all I need. I search for Wally's number, and that's when I notice. No service. Shit, I say. A baby noise bubbles from Willow, a squawk of sorts, as if in solidarity with me. Fern? Is that you? I freeze inside the stall. It's Carmel's voice. It is you, she says after a minute. I recognize your shoes. I look down at my shoes, sequined silver sneakers that are unlikely to belong to anyone else at the library. Are you alone? I ask. Yes, it's just me. I open the door. Carmel opens her mouth as if to say something, but then she sees Willow. She sucks in a breath. You had your baby! Yes. I smile down at her, wriggling in my arms. Carmel creeps